On the programme, Jimmy's Hall, Ken Loach in Leitrim, and the filming of the Jim Gralton story.
Off you go, Monty. Take down the fence.
He's gentle, but shot through with steel. Keeps his eye on the ball all the time, and he never rests.
Because it's the story of a socialist, a man who was deported from Ireland as an alien. And then as the script came in dribs and drabs, it brought it to life so much.
Everybody now! Get your heads down on the floor!
Voices and sounds there from the set of the new Ken Loach film Jimmy's Hall, which has been made on location in Leitrim and Sligo over the past months. The film, seen by Loach and his screenwriter Paul Laverty, as a natural follow-on to his 2006 film The Wind That Shakes the Barley, tells some of the story of Jimmy Gralton, the only Irish citizen deported from this country since independence. He was deported to New York in August 1933 as an undesirable alien, shorthand for socialist and land rights agitator. The hall of the film's title, the Pierce Connolly Hall at Efferna, which he'd built as a centre for education, music, dance and community life, had been attacked and burnt down, and he himself denounced as an antichrist by local Catholic clergy. The story had been told by Pat Feely in a radio documentary, by Des Guckian in his book Deported, and by Donal O'Kelly in his theatre piece Jimmy Gralton's Dance Hall, which toured the Northwest in the past 2 years. Tonight, we visit the set of the new film, talk to Ken Loach, to writer Paul Laverty, producer Rebecca O'Brien, and some of those taking part in the film, and consider its potential to help foster the small but growing arts and film scene in Leitrim and Sligo. Paul Laverty, how did you hear about Jim Gralton?
I'm very glad to talk about this because I think this is another little ripple from Nicaragua. I went there in the 80s and I worked for a solidarity organisation when the United States was trying to destroy the Sandinista Revolution. And in that trip I met a wonderful character called Donal O'Kelly, who in my view is a marvellous writer and playwright in his own right and a wonderful actor too. And I'm glad to see he was in acting yesterday. What attracted us to the story, I suppose, was Jimmy Gralton and his friends. I think they saw human beings in the round. You know, I mean, this hall where we're standing right in front of it just now, I mean, it's a place of education. It's a place to come and do boxing, to do literature classes, to do dancing, to hear music. You know, and I love that mix of things. You know, and it reminds me of the Emma Goldman quote, the anarchist who said, you know, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. And that's what I loved about it. You know, it wasn't just all serious. It saw human beings and all their diversity and the different needs we have, you know, and also a place where we could meet and think and discuss and analyse in safety with your friends. And I think that's something that's very, very basic to us. And in a strange sense, I think that's what came under threat, free spaces like that. So although with a tiny little premise to a story, imagine that this little hall in this almost, you know, this theological gulag was one of the free spaces, you know, in 1932. And I thought we could tell, you know, a kind of a story that would unfold, that would have lots of levels to it. And I suppose that was the great attraction. So I owed Donal O'Kelly a fine bottle of whiskey.
I remember John McGarvin, when he spoke about Gralton back in 1986, he talked about how, you know, the importance of the local, how it can become universal, and that this story had ramifications that could touch everyone, that could touch people everywhere. And I suppose what seems apparent is that what you're trying to do in this film and with your script is to tell a story that can be understood anywhere.
Yes, I think if you're truthful to the particular, it'll often have reflections in other parts of the world. You know, the conditions might change, but you know, I suspect people watching this in present day Iran will have something to say about it. You know, or people living in some communities in the United States and ad infinitum. You know, where freedom is under attack. And that's another very important point I would like to make, I suppose, too, is we know a lot about Jimmy and the hall, but you know, in a film you really have to kind of delve into the personal, you know, into the private, into the world of his private imagination, into the world of relationships, you know, and it's really quite impossible to know what all that would have been, you know. So there's kind of great space for trying to be truthful to the times and then imagine the relationships, you know. So his friends around him, you know, who we've had to imagine these people. In relation to the priests as well, there were several priests mentioned, but we have a fictional priest, and we have a composite in a sense, and I hope we're doing justice to with the figure of Father Sheridan, who was played by Jim Norton, a wonderful actor. And in a ways, I think Father Sheridan was more complex than the priests whose sermons I read and researched for this really were.
Do you in some way see, not that it matters particularly, but do you see a link between this film and The Wind That Shakes the Barley in terms of something of the narrative of post-independence or kind of pre- and post-independence Irish history?
Well, it's a continuation. You know, it's 10 years later. And I think that's a very interesting question too, because I'm reminded of a line from The Wind That Shakes the Barley when they execute the person who is informed in the IRA, and he says to the men of the flying column, he says, "You will never win, you know, and if you guys take over," I'm paraphrasing, they didn't say guys then, and they said, "It'll be a priest-infected backwater," you know, and it is quite interesting really to reflect on those words, you know, when you hear the speeches of, you know, the 1930s from the priests in this area. You know, when you hear the Bishop of Galway saying, you know, "Fathers, if your daughters are not back at the appointed hour, lay the lash upon their back." This is not my imagination. Those are the words of the Bishop of Galway. And there's many other ones there. And of course, you know, in the little bit after this, 1934, you know, they had the anti-jazz marches, you know. They were fascinated by occasions of sin. They had wonderful phrases like "company keeping under the stars." Makes it sound very exciting,
it does,
doesn't it, really?
I don't know.
Yes, I suspect they might have enjoyed it in their own private imaginations as well. But it did become like a very, you know, oppressive atmosphere, because it wasn't just sermons from the pulpit. I mean, the hall came under attack. There was bullets fired into the hall. There was mines laid. Jimmy, as far as I can see, certainly some reports said the hayricks were burned, stones thrown at his house. In 1921, he had to flee. And just looking at all the evidence, I mean, it's hard to believe that his life was not in danger. And so there were kind of, there were violent times, really. And you know, this free space was burnt to a cinder.
And of course, when you went looking for some of the official records,
yes, I
discovered they didn't exist.
Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? You know, it's funny whose stories we celebrate and those that we don't. And I thought it was very, very interesting that these historical records have simply disappeared. Nobody knows. And I'm sure they wanted to wipe this slate clean. So it does give me a kind of great pleasure to see such a huge big gang here today, dancing and singing. And a wonderful little girl called Roisin today playing the violin. There's another lovely little girl who's dancing. And that's what happened in that hall. There was kind of I think we're kind of celebrating that spirit of resistance. And not only that, but a spirit of fun, which I think we all need to nourish our resistance. We need both. I think they're symbiotic.
Paul Laverty, scriptwriter on Jimmy's Hall there. Rebecca O'Brien is the third vital element of the trinity of Loach, Laverty and O'Brien, director, writer and producer. They've been a team for many years and together have made many of Ken Loach's classic films. I asked her how she sees her role as producer.
My role is to have an overall view of the shape of the film and to be there as a sort of constant second opinion for Ken and Paul to hit off. And also, I often see myself as the first audience, and I take that role seriously as being, you know, what I have to contribute is really as, you know, as a member of the audience. The three of us, because you should include
Paul
Laverty as well. I mean, the three of us, we're good friends and we each know what the other does. There's so many conversations that you don't have to have so that you can actually converse about the things which are germane to the thing you're working on. So, and it makes it much easier to make something which could otherwise be seen as unwieldy and big and slightly terrifying. I mean, the scale, this is actually the biggest film we've made.
Would you say that it's a bigger scale film than The Wind That Shakes the Barley?
Well, it is, because there was so much preparation to get it right, and there's a full group of dancers. There's 32 dancers, there's who all needed training, it's period, it's got a bigger cast than The Wind That Shakes the Barley, and a bigger crowd than The Wind That Shakes the Barley, so that makes it bigger. And a period film always, certainly with music and dancing in it, I mean, it's almost a musical, requires a lot more production input. And so, yeah, the budget is slightly bigger. And I mean, what we don't have is the war stuff, which is a relief. But there's a few special effects here and there.
What kind of budget are we talking about, roughly?
Well, that would be giving away all my state secrets, but I would call it a middling budget. I mean, it's tiny on Hollywood scales, but it's sort of it's round about the €6-7 million mark.
So in terms of Irish film, it is very substantial, and you can see the impact of that already in a community, a local community like this in Leitrim. It has brought, apart from bringing a real spirit into the place, I think it has an economic effect as well.
Oh, definitely. There is always an economic effect of a film arriving in town because, quite apart from the fact that we're employing a lot of local people to be in the film, but also to help make the film, the economic effect of a film is not to be sniffed at, and it's great. But it's also, there's what I would call the potential for a cultural ownership of the film, whereby the people involved, it's their film, it's not just our film, it's their film as well, it belongs to the people of the area. And when you get that happening, you really feel that you've got under the skin. I mean, a lot of filmmakers go in and will go into a place and make the film, and it's all on the surface and everybody's delighted to see them, but then they're gone, as we will be gone when we've done it. But you want something there to be a legacy. I mean, you want the fact that there's 32 people who know how to dance really well and they'll teach their kids, and or there's people who will be inspired by the spirit of Jimmy Gralton, and hopefully that spirit, people will learn more about him and things like that. So you hope that there will be, that bringing his story to light, there will be a feeling that this character is ours. He belongs to Leitrim and Sligo area, and we helped tell that story. And when we made The Wind That Shakes the Barley, had the same feeling in Cork, and it was great to film it there. But actually, because Cork is such a huge county, we were all over Cork, and it was we were in different areas. But here we've been part of one big community, and so it's had even more of a cultural effect, perhaps than we did on Barley. But they owned it in Cork, and then Ireland owned it, and Ireland made it their favourite independent film. So we hope, fingers crossed, that we might be able to have a similar effect with this one.
Producer Rebecca O'Brien there.
Do we want parity or justice? Do we want the breakup of these big estates that are landless?
Yes. Yes.
That was Barry Ward playing the lead role of Jimmy Gralton in the film Jimmy's Hall. I spoke to him on a rather windy day on set near Drumahair.
The bits I had read online, I found to be a very fascinating guy, someone I wanted to find out more about, failed to do so because there's so little out there about him. We never got the script. Paul and Ken work in ways which we're the last to know of anything.
Work in mysterious ways.
Yes, exactly. So we get it in dribs and drabs. And obviously it's loosely inspired, as it says on the first page, it's loosely inspired by the events. So I had read a kind of chronological event plot point kind of thing about Jimmy's life. And then as the script came in dribs and drabs, it brought it to life so much. It's a thrill. It's a real gift for us every night to go back to the hotel with it, with new pages, you know. So it's unfolding for me as it goes along.
We just heard you earlier give a kind of rousing speech as a family are reinstated in a house from which they'd been evicted. And I suppose it's a centrepiece, and it really goes to the core of what Gralton believed, to his I suppose, both his personal politics and to the broader political landscape. I mean, yeah. That must be a great speech to give.
Oh, yeah, like it's every what every actor wants, really. It's a gift, yeah. But it's a brilliant and true dramatic way of showing, as you said, Jimmy the person and the wider political landscape of the time, and why he set up the hall was to implement these kind of, to implement justice.
You came back, I think, to spend a bit of time in Leitrim, to listen to the accent and try to get it, not necessarily right, but get a real sense of it. And of course, it varies from place to place anyway. Mm. So you were up around South Leitrim, I think,
about a month. I stayed in Drumshanbo on Loch Allen, which was stunning, really, really beautiful place. And my sister had an old workmate who moved down here and lived on a farm. So they very kindly took me under their wings and got me lots of local farm work. So I had a few days on the farm and bogs, but of course everything now is much more advanced technologically than it was back then. So I was, while they were driving tractors and collecting hay and baling it, I was running around with a rake. They thought I was kind of insane, a little touched. But it was a great experience, yeah, just to live how...
To touch into the land again.
Exactly.
What does it mean to you as an actor to get a role like this in a new Ken Loach film, telling a story that I suppose really needed to be told? And in a sense, it is a continuation of The Wind That Shakes the Barley. So it is a significant film, which will get a lot of international attention.
Yeah, it's life-changing. I mean, whatever happens to it, if it's seen by anyone, the process itself is what it's about for me. And that in itself has been life-changing. And yeah, to get a lead in a Ken Loach movie, that's the stuff of dreams.
The stuff of dreams, actor Barry Ward there. Music plays a vital element in the film Jimmy's Hall, as it did in the original Pierce Connolly Hall in its day. John Carty and Seamus O'Dowd are two of the musicians involved in the music for the film. John Carty and Seamus O'Dowd, you're both involved in the music for Jimmy's Hall. Tell me about what you've been doing musically in the film.
Well, it's been kind of interesting. It's been interesting, right? Because there's been a jazz band and a traditional band involved in the music. Because like Jimmy would have been among the first people to bring jazz to Ireland. So today we're myself and John, there's a whole bunch of us there, Jesse Smith and more. We're kind of doing the traditional thing. But the last time around, I was playing with jazz musicians. So it's been an interesting exercise musically, for sure.
Yeah, and of course you have the great facility to play both. You can manage a bit of trad and to give it a whirl. Anyway.
Give it a go anyway. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
John, of course you play 1930s music, and you're kind of decked out in the suit, appropriate suit for the period today. It must be a great experience to be in this film.
It is, because a lot of our musical background, we're pretending to play like the 1930s musicians. So here we are, actually dressed up in the whole attire, and you know, I'm being encouraged to play music from around Leitrim here, music of John McKenna and James Morrison and people like that. So couldn't be in a better movie, really. Yeah, it's very, very enjoyable. It's a lot of the material, as I say, has been handpicked too, to give the authenticity of the time, with Harry Bradley and Charlie Harris there. I mean, they're steeped in the music of that era, you know, from around these parts. So it's been good fun.
So it should make for a pretty good soundtrack.
I think so. Hopefully so. We've done our best anyway, you know. but I think it should. I think because it's interesting, because as John was saying, that the music from this area, I think it's stayed, like, probably from how it's been played, between how it was played in the 30s to how it's played in the present day. Like a lot of the elements have stayed pretty solid, I think, and people play, like a lot of people from Sligo, let's say, people like suppose based here, like Mossy Martin, or let's say Liam Kelly or Shane Mitchell in Sligo, that'd be playing music even in the more modern style, but with a kind of an eye on how people were doing it back in the 20s and 30s. Yeah.
There was a template at this part of the country, you know, that really hasn't been surpassed. Like it was a great template for all traditional Irish music, and
It's evident in everybody's playing today. It really is, yeah.
Yeah, you think of the musicians from this area, the extraordinary, the music, and, you know, Joe Lackey Gallagher from Drumcarran, and it's just wonderful, wonderful music. And as well, it is, again, I just find it quite moving that music is brought into a story like this, because something can become, can easily or could easily become very simply political. But of course, I mean, the music could have been a huge part of that landscape and that story.
Yeah, and it was a big transition period from traditional music to a more broad-ranging music, jazz. But jazz could have been anything that time, doing our own bits of research. It didn't necessarily mean like Dixieland jazz. It could be just a modern tune, you know?
That's great. It's just great. I suppose it's great for us to sort of get a feel for maybe how the music would have felt that time as well, maybe even in the terms of the sense of occasion. I think myself and John, we'd have all heard from older musicians what it was like, you know, and we'd have heard lots of stories when we were growing up, but actually it almost feels like being in one of those stories at the moment. Like it's kind of, in a way that's kind of, when you look around, it's almost like you're back in those times, in a way. You're back in the 20s and 30s, like.
Jimmy O'Dowd there with John Carty on the set of the film Jimmy's Hall. Well, Paul Gralton is a relative of Jimmy Gralton's, a relative, as it happens, on both sides, and proud to be associated with him.
What happened to Jimmy was actually fundamentally wrong. There was a complete failure of the judicial process. And if you set that against Jimmy's record in terms of settling disputes here, all of which were upheld by the courts, you have a kind of strange paradox that the person who was deported, who was actually had stood for law and order in a sense, and had stood for good sound practice. We also took the cast of Jimmy's crew, if you like, on a tour of Leitrim and parts of Roscommon, just going through some of the historical sites, including the farm, the site where the hall was at Effiner, Drumherney House, and also up to the Red Lodge, which is where the Milmo family were put back onto the land. So I just showed them a few key places, and we talked about what had happened and talked about what we knew about Jimmy. My father was there, and my mother, and my Aunt Connie as well. So they kind of were very much more connected to it in terms of time. So we're just going through those things and giving them a sense of not just Jimmy, but Leitrim and Roscommon as well. Because I always think there's something about the landscape here. There's a real power in the landscape. And I really love being down on the farm and looking at Shimor and Slievenhir, and you get a sense of timelessness as well as that sense of political unrest and unsettlements. I think Ken really will bring something different to the story. It's great for people like Des Guckian, who actually put the story in print at an important time and actually raised a level of consciousness around Jimmy, at least in Ireland. Now it's going international. So.
Paul Gralton there on the set of the new Ken Loach film, Jimmy's Hall. And we'll be back shortly with Ken Loach talking about that film on the story of Jimmy Gralton.
It's a long, dark tunnel you enter when you start to shoot, and it's just hard work really from day one. But the enjoyment is in moments when you can forget the mountain you've got to climb.
RTE Radio 1.
You're listening to Arts Tonight with Vincent Woods.
When Roisin plays, there you are. Very good. Have you remembered the steps?
Yeah.
Good. So that's what it starts with. And then after that, at some point, there'll be the musicians will strike up and we'll do a dance.
Director Ken Loach there on the set of Jimmy's Hall, which will be released next summer.
Matt! You okay?
It's fascinating to watch Loach on set. He hovers around the centre and edge of all, seems to know everyone's name, even the most recent extras. He's unfailingly patient and courteous, seems gentle, almost slightly absent or abstracted. But you sense that he knows exactly what he wants and is determined to get it. I met Loach in Drumsna in Leitrim just after he finished filming Jimmy's Hall. Ken Loach, what has it meant making this film in Leitrim on Jim Gralton?
Well, it was a return trip to Ireland, which was a pleasure. It's the third film we've done here. And in both the previous two, we've been excoriated by the right wing, the British press, which is most of them. So I'm hoping we achieve a hat trick, because if we don't, we haven't told the story right. Because it's the story of a socialist, a man who was deported from Ireland as an alien, they're born here. A
a socialist who believed you had to liberate the human spirit as well as achieve economic demands, and I think that's very important. So heroic story, and I hope we do Jimmy Carlton justice.
How do you see the film, if you do, fitting into the narrative of post-independence Irish history and linking, in a sense, to the story of the wind that shakes the barley?
Well, it's 10 years after the War of Independence and the Civil War. And there was a line in the film we did about that. We talked about it becoming a priest-infested backwater. And I guess there's some who say that might have happened. As from the country who oppressed the Irish people for centuries, it's not for me to say. But maybe there's some truth in it.
I think I remember a line in The Wind That Shakes the Barley. I think it's Dan who says that without a social revolution, all that will change is the accents of the powerful and the colour of the flag. And I suppose, in a way, that's very much what Carlton was about.
There was a left that continued the struggle for social justice. But they lost fairly heavily in the 20s. And by the time it came to the early 30s, they were very much in the minority, so Carlton didn't get the support that he needed.
I remember I was in Effernay in McLaughlin's pub the night John McGarren launched Des Guckin's book Deported on the Carlton story, and he said that night that these local histories speak to us more intimately than the great histories of state, and he also said the people who supported Carlton and he himself served human liberty. And those two things really stayed in my mind around this story, and I presume they would also go to the kernel of what you'd feel about it.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I don't see it as a local story. I think it's much more than a local story. Jimmy Carlton himself spent most of his life through force outside Ireland. The people who supported him came from across Ireland. So every story happened somewhere, but I think it's much more than a local story. And the people who support him certainly stood for liberty and social justice. And of course the enemies of course are all around us today, the same people, but they appear in a different form. You know, they're the free marketeers now. They're the neoliberals. They're the ones who say there's no other alternative except privatisation and deregulation and mass unemployment
and austerity.
And that it's still a small the voice of Carlton would still be a small voice today numerically, but very important.
Were you familiar with these particular landscapes around the Northwest and Leitrim before you began to work on the film?
Not really, no. I knew Dublin, I knew the area around Cork, obviously. But I didn't know, the Sligo and Leitrim. But it's a magnificent countryside, beautiful country. I'm not sure about the number of small bungalows everywhere. If I can say without being cheeky, it's significant that Ireland was more noted for its writers than its architects, which is a pity because the landscape is magnificent. But I think the preservation of old buildings is maybe undervalued.
Because there was a very beautiful aesthetic, a vernacular architecture here, the old thatched houses with the simple elegance. And I suppose there's a touch of that in Carlton's house and in what would have been a thatched house. And that simplicity of an architecture that fitted in the landscape was a big part of what was here.
Yes, well, absolutely. I mean, not everybody can now live in a small stone thatched cottage, but that idiom was very important, and of course those old buildings absolutely are part of the landscape, and I think they should be cherished. And it's just sad to see so many of them in disrepair.
And of course, you tapped into the local spirit and the local people, the community, using many locals in the film, which I suppose is part of the ethic of what you do. Were you again? I mean, many of those people would not have acted before, and they seemed, from the little bit that I observed, they seemed to have taken to it all with great relish.
I mean, it was really important that that the people here played a part in it, and there's lots of people from Sligo and Leitrim and the surrounding area who play really important parts, and it should feel part of it. The people should be a part of the landscape as much as the buildings, you know. Obviously, some people came from a bit further afield, but I think the sense of place is important in the people as well as in the buildings. It should seem homogenous.
Did you enjoy making this film as much as any film you've ever made before?
Well, enjoy is not quite the word. I mean, it's a long, dark tunnel you enter when you start to shoot, and it's just hard work really from day one, but the enjoyment is in moments when you can forget the mountain you've got to climb. But the people gave us a huge lift and a huge buoyancy, you know, to work from. I mean, everyone involved was magnificent. I mean, it's a real privilege to be with them. Mainly Irish, an Irish crew, a large contingent from Scotland, and just a few of us from England. But we were a happy team.
What have these Irish films meant to you?
I think they were an opportunity to try and set the record straight as far as we could, and as far as we understood it, just as a record of what the British have done, the British ruling class have done to Ireland and the Irish people, and the centuries of oppression and brutality and violence that is not recognised in our country. And I don't think you can understand British history or Irish history unless you understand the relationship between the British ruling class and the Irish. But I think it's a class issue. I mean, my ancestors were farm labourers and coal miners, mainly. And it was the same people who kicked the shit out of them that brutalised the Irish. So it's not one nationality against another, it's one class against another. And it was the opportunity to try to explore that was satisfying.
I had recently seen your documentary, The Spirit of 45, and it struck me as ironic that Jimmy Gralton died in that same year, in 1945, in New York. So he never lived to see the social changes that came with that shift and the Labour government in Britain, and a lot of it, of course, pulled back now. But the spirit of optimism that was there at that time. It's rather hard to hold to that now, and yet in making the work that you make, you seem to be saying one should never give up and never give in.
Well, history is dynamic, so yes, you know there are whatever catastrophe happens, or disaster, or unfortunate series of events happens, there's always the chance for the alternative, for the opposite. I think Jimmy Gralton would have been quite critical of what happened in 45, as many of us are in retrospect, in that it was a social democratic change, a certain restructuring to regenerate private industry. But it did include public ownership of the utilities and the health service. There were huge advances, but we shouldn't be uncritical of them. As you say, they've been lost now in this tide of neoliberal politics to put everything back into private industry, which will destroy us. Really.
as one thing, and again, it may seem like a small thing, but it could be a very big thing. And I know that some of the young filmmakers around here were delighted to have a little bit of access to the film, to the making of it, to watching it work. And I think there is a real possibility that what you've done here will help this fledgling film industry in around North Leitrim, you know, to grow and to inspire people to do their own work.
Well, I'd hope so. I mean, a number of things have to change in order for that to happen. I mean, there has to be proper funding for proper budgets, because you can't make films unless you work with good professionals who are entitled to a proper wage. So you've got to have a proper budget. It's very difficult to do good work, and unless it's a properly set up film financially. And also, the cinemas have got to show European and other films. I mean, sadly, the cinema in Sligo seems to exist on a diet of violent American films, and it's primarily about selling fast food. You know, as long as we treat the cinema in with such contempt, we can't expect films to be made, because there's no space for them. So the cinema's got to change, and the financing's got to change. And, you know, however many people come and say encouraging things, nothing will change unless those structural changes happen.
Is there a little bit of your heart left here as you wind up on this film?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't meet such sympathetic people and such warm and generous people and not be touched by them. And I hope the feeling is mutual, that we kind of learn from each other and give a bit to each other and take good memories, really, because we have great memories. Whether the film will be any good, I don't know. You know, it's not. You can work very hard and work with brilliant people, and sometimes, you know, like in cooking, the cake doesn't rise. I mean, we don't know yet. We'll have to see. No, you can't help but be moved by the experience.
So we'll let you off to the mixing. Ken Loach, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
At the site of the original Piers Connolly Hall at Efferna, I meet local historian, writer and former teacher Des Guckian, whose book Deported helped bring the story of Jim Gralton back into the light when it was published in 1986. Des Guckian, we're here in Efferna at the site of Jim Gralton's Piers Connolly Hall, and you might read the sign there for us.
Okay, Vincent. It's the site of the Piers Connolly Memorial Hall, and the sign says it was erected in memory of Jimmy Gralton, Leitrim socialist, who was deported for his political beliefs on August the 13th in 1933.
Now, you wrote this book, Deported, Jimmy Gralton, 1886-1945, and I remember I was here in Efferna in 1986 for the launching of that here in McLaughlin's pub behind us, and John McGarren launched that on the night. Do you remember much of that night, Des?
Oh, it was a thrilling night, because it was very good to get John to come across, I suppose about 10 miles across South Leitrim, and to launch it for us. He did us the honour, and a very great honour. He was at his very best that night, very lyrical, but very concise in what he said. I think he did a tremendous job, and he summed it up very, very well.
In Pat Feely's RTE radio documentary, The Gralton Affair, from 1977, Patrick Gralton describes the opposition of local clergy to the Piers Connolly Hall.
In 1932, he came back from America, and a lot of us young people brought pressure on him to open the hall. So he said that we could open it if we wished, but that we would be getting into difficulties with the clergy. The hall was opened anyway, and there were fear crowds for some time. Then Father O'Dowd started that this Gralton was back again, and that he was a communist agent, and for no one to go to the hall. Still the people kept going, not as much as in the beginning. Then he went round to all the houses that had people, whose people were going to the hall, and he but brought pressure on them not to go near the hall. Father Cosgrove was preaching Sunday after Sunday, as well as Father O'Dowd in Gowell, Father O'Dowd in particular, about this communist in our midst. And he was a paid agent. And for the people going to the hall, that if they didn't cease going, that if there was work or anything going on, that they mightn't be coming to him. And he brought great pressure, terrible pressure on the people of the locality.
Back in Efrina, Des Guckin sums up the Jimmy Gralton story.
What was involved was a terrible wrong done to Jimmy Gralton and to his mother, who was still alive and who was an elderly lady left on her own while her only son living was sent off to the United States and never was allowed to return. So it was a terrible tragedy and a very unchristian act, I would think. John McGaherty referred to an insecure state and an insular church cooperating in deporting Jimmy Gralton, deporting him illegally, I would add, and very much so.
Des, what kind of response did you get when you first wrote about Gralton back in the early 80s? I think it was 1982 you wrote about him in the Leitrim Guardian, won the literary award, and McGaherty talked about this conspiracy of silence around Gralton and his story. And in a way, I think you witnessed something of the continuing power of that when you began to write and talk about him.
There was very little said about it. People just remained quiet. I suppose they were maybe intimidated into it. They probably were told that it was of no importance. People didn't want to admit that there had been an awful mistake made, a tragic mistake made, and that the man was very much wronged. So I suppose the people around here were good enough, they would have remembered it, but they would have kept it in their heart, they would have kept it silent and unto themselves. I suppose I was breaking the rule of omerta when I came out in, I wrote the essay in 1982, and I kind of by accident nearly it got the literary award in the Leitrim Guardian. And it did open up the whole story, the whole question of what was wrong with Gralton.
Are you glad to see this story being told now in a feature film that will get international attention and will be shown, for instance, in New York, where Gralton lived for those last years of his life, where he died in 1945. There must be a certain gratification in knowing that the story lives and will be known by more people now.
The ripples are going out and out and out across the world, and I'm sure Ken Loach's contribution is very much to be welcomed. I would kind of slightly quibble with his title, Jimmy's Hall, because nobody ever called it Jimmy's Hall. They called it Gralton's Hall. They didn't even call it the Pierce Connolly Hall, but it was simply Gralton's Hall here locally.
And would he have been known as James or Jimmy or Jim locally?
Oh, very much Jimmy. Be no highfalutin stuff at all around Leitrim. It was very plain and simple.
Des Guckin there, author of Deported. As with all of Ken Loach's films, there was a strong local involvement in the making of Jimmy's Hall. Many people working as extras, some getting bigger parts, musicians playing for dance scenes in the hall. There was a real sense of local ownership and pride in the work being done. For people like Drumahaire-based filmmaker Johnny Gogan, the making of Jimmy's Hall has been a boost and an inspiration. Johnny Gogan, as a filmmaker in Leitrim and the North West, what does it mean to have had Ken Loach around for the last few months?
Well, apart from being one of the great filmmakers of this age, he's a great teacher. I mean, I've been working on the making of documentary for the production, and just watching him work, he's got a very unique way of working. So as long as you're open to keep on learning, then he's a great teacher. He has got incredible focus. He's, as Jim Norton said, he's gentle but shot through with steel. I mean, he just keeps his eye on the ball all the time, and he never rests. I mean, he's like a shark. He kind of moves around all the time, and he doesn't sit down during the day at all, which is incredible for a man, you know, in his late 70s. So it's that thing, keep going, keep working, and you'll have a great career.
Am I right in thinking there was a character called Johnny Gogan in The Wind That Shakes the Barley?
There is
a coincidence. There is one of the good guys.
There is a character. Paul Laverty is the screenwriter on Wind That Shakes the Barley and on Jimmy's Hall. I know him for 25 years, and he has this habit of putting his friends' names in the film. So I was honoured. I was taken a bit by surprise, but I was honoured. Yeah.
Somebody like Loach, somebody of that stature in the area, must be an inspiration for you personally, but I presume as well it is a real boost to people who are interested in film, working in the area, and you know, you have a film like Black Ice in the cinemas at the moment. Something, you know, a film like this being made here must have a more enduring significance.
Yeah, I mean, the key thing is that it's a story from here. That is what's so powerful, that he's telling a story that's coming from here. And secondly, he's engaging with a lot of talent from here, artistic talent, even just the dancers, the dance teachers, the artistic people are working in the design team. So, and then right through to construction. You know, it's actually having a big economic impact as well. So, and it gives us confidence, because what we're trying to do here is to build an industry, a film industry, organically, if you like, in an area that hasn't had an industry heretofore.
Building that must be challenging. I'm sure it must have its difficulties. And I know that this is a difficult time for Irish filmmakers generally, because of that shift in all the cinemas now, where the length of a run of a film is dependent on the takings in the first weekend, which seems ludicrous and must make it very hard for independent filmmakers like yourself to get the film that will run and last.
Well, I think what we're looking for is authenticity. And the great thing about here is that there's wonderful writers, there's wonderful artistic talent, and there's directing talent. I mean, I live in North Leitrim, and Conor McDermott Rowe is based there a lot of the time. Marion Quinn is based there. So, you know, we have the talent across the different aspects of film production to actually build from inside and then to attract films into the region. And then it's a question of, like, some films will work and some films won't work with the box office, but it is a question of actually having a body of work to find the success.
Filmmaker Johnny Gogan there. Professor Luke Gibbons of NUI Maynooth is familiar with the story of Jimmy Gralton. He wrote about it in his collection of Field Day essays, Transformations in Irish Culture, and of course he's also co-author of the book Cinema and Ireland. Luke Gibbons, remind us, who was Jim Gralton and what's the significance of his story in the history of modern Ireland?
James Gralton is that, if you like, standard figure in one way, a returned American who comes back to his locality. But unlike John Wayne and the Quiet Man, who comes back to find home and tranquility, Gralton came back to turn the world upside down. He was an idealist. He had been, the family had been heavily involved in the land war, and, if you like, organisation and unrest was in the family DNA. But Gralton himself joined the British Army, refused to go to India, and thereby found himself an outlier. He immigrated to America, got heavily involved in labour politics in the US, was attracted to Larkinism, and above all to Connolly and Pierce. So he came back to Ireland on a wave of optimism and insurgency during the War of Independence and Civil War period, and indeed was involved in the Civil War, and that's where he founded the Pierce Connolly Hall as much as a centre of mobilisation and instruction and community gathering as entertainment and the likes. So he was so disillusioned after the Civil War that he went back to the United States. But then, eternal optimist that he was drawn back again when Fianna Fáil came to power in the early 1930s, and indeed even joined the local Fianna Fáil Cumann, which was not a good career move for someone who was now a communist. One of the things I think the myth of Gralton exposes is the myth of community itself, that communities are divided in all kinds of ways that are, if you like, bandaged over or camouflaged over in the interest of putting the best foot forward. But Gralton if you like, tore the mask of this imaginary community and ended up with not only the church against him, not only Fine Gael against him, not only Fianna Fáil against him, but even the IRA against him. And it was, in fact, there's still argument about who burned the hall, but there was strong suspicion that the IRA were against him. And key figures like Maura McSweeney in the Republican movement railed against Gralton as a divisive influence because he wasn't focusing just on the nation. He said the enemy is within as well as without, meaning class politics and class struggle. So Gralton really was almost like a seismic upheaval in the countryside of County Leitrim in the early 1930s, which was already in ferment and was already a very volatile social scene because of precisely De Valera coming to power. The Republican conflict in the area was very strong.
Are you surprised that there was so much silence around his story for so long? Because I suppose apart from Pat Feely's RTE radio documentary and Des Guckian's book Deported, and you've written about him yourself, there was very little about Gralton in official history.
It was remarkable how little was said about Gralton. In a sense, it was kind of a whispering campaign rather than a communications network. And one heard about him partly due to, I suppose, the Erigna coal mines is not too far from the area, and the Transport and General Workers Union were militant enough in the Erigna coal mines. And indeed, there was a big strike in 1969 in the coal mines. And that's the first time I heard of Gralton, because there was an Erigna Soviet in 1920. But again, one heard very little about the Erigna Soviet. One did hear about Father Michael O'Flanagan, who was the agrarian protester and was the radical agrarian priest. And indeed, Gralton was compared to Father O'Flanagan, and Father O'Flanagan would be on the side of Gralton. But having said that, given that communities are supposed to know everything about each other and nothing is meant to be a secret, in fact, the official histories of communities have a great power in suppressing alternative histories, or what historians like to call history from below.
A film like this, Jimmy's Hall, should bring international attention to the landscape of Leitrim to the northwest, and I suppose to this suppressed part of our history. But one would also hope that it will boost the fledgling film industry there, you know, and help acknowledge the work of people like Donal Kelly and Johnny Gogan, who will be there when Ken Loach is gone and the making of this film is a part of history. Because I suppose one would always hope, and I think that's Rebecca O'Brien has said that is their hope as well, that this film coming in to the Northwest will help the people who are trying to make film and make art there.
Yeah, I think one of the most remarkable turns in recent Irish cinema has been the retreat from Romantic Ireland, meaning the more picturesque landscape of Kerry or Connemara, and, if you like, a retreat to the psychotic grass, as one writer called it, of Roscommon and Leitrim and Westmeath. In other words, the unpicturesque landscape, the landscape that Patrick Kavanagh wrote about, or indeed Heaney wrote about. And the difficulty is that can be written about, but it's not, on the face of it, very scenic. But that's exactly what I think is at stake, that this is lived territory. Each layer seems camped on before, as Seamus Heaney put it. And I think what you have in recent years, the number of films made by someone like Johnny Gogan, who filmed this film Mapmaker, but whose current film Black Ice is now on exhibition in multiplexes in Dublin, which is a remarkable achievement. But also a film like Korea, Cathal Black's film set in Leitrim, again based on a John McGaughran story, with a backstory again of the Civil War. So I think one of the undiscovered countries of Irish filmmaking is precisely the Midlands. It's precisely the outlying areas that tourism avoided in the heyday of Killarney and Connemara. But in a sense now, these have become the last, if you like, outposts of authenticity in areas that have already been spoken for. So I think in a sense, Leitrim's best days might yet be to come. And if Ken Loach and Gralton play a hand in this, it's hard to believe.
Professor Luke Gibbons of NUI Maynooth. And Jimmy's Hall will be released next summer. Thanks to all the production team on the film for giving us this radio glimpse into filmmaking and an important part of history retold. That's it from us. Next week, Opera in Ireland, a new team at OTC, Opera Theatre Company, as they tour Carmen. Wexford Festival begins. Northern Ireland Opera stages Gerald Barry's The Importance of Being Earnest. The season begins, but what is the state and status of opera in Ireland today? Join us next Monday night at 10. Till then, goodbye.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods, was produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions.